ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The Economy Stupid is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
So Priya, do you see yourself as a creative person?
I don't.
Really? But you are a creative person.
I don't think by definition I am. I really struggle, Norman, to do the things that I consider creative. Painting, anything musical. I look at those people in awe.
Yeah, but you write books. Well, you've written one book at least.
They're sciencey.
Right.
Even the kids' book is sciencey. It's telling kids about rainbows. Are you creative?
I'd love to think of myself as an artist. I think there are little, little sprinkles of creativity.
I'm creative in the kitchen. Actually, I'll give myself that.
So you don't follow menus?
Recipes.
It was always throwing menus.
I do follow recipes.
This shows you how rarely I follow a recipe because I forget the word for it.
I follow recipes sometimes, but I'm very good at improvising and I'm quite creative in the kitchen. So perhaps I am creative.
Well, creativity is one of the things we're going to be talking about, where it rests in the brain. Coming up on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, a huge study looking at colon cancer survivors and their rates of relapse when they're put in a structured exercise program. The results could be game-changing.
And the moving story of two close friends, one of whom had a devastating stroke, only for the other to have a stroke 20 years later.
I couldn't comprehend that I'd had a stroke. Then when I had gained consciousness again, I wasn't the same person.
Well, it's been a big year for these drugs, we're calling them GLP-1s, it just trips off the tongue. Everybody trips off everybody's tongue, but we shouldn't really use brand names, but we're talking about Ozempic, Wegovy.
Yes, we're talking about the class of medications which are currently injectable. They were originally developed for type 2 diabetes and they've now found a big space or home in weight management.
They have. And this year, they've really been pitched as a revolution.
It's hard to know where to begin, but I think probably one of the biggest pieces of research that came out about the GLP-1s was in Nature Medicine earlier this year in January, and it was the study of more than 2 million people with diabetes involving the database from the US Department of Veterans Affairs that looked at the effectiveness of these medications and their additional benefits. And what they really did was systematically give us an atlas of the associations of the GLP-1 use and what else people might actually yield benefit from. And it came out that there was a reduced risk of substance use and psychotic disorders, seizures, diagnoses like Alzheimer's disease and dementia. There was heart benefits. And it was the first time I think we really got a feel for the other positive effects.
Yeah, because initially they thought, well, if you've got diabetes, you're at increased risk of dementia, increased risk of kidney disease, heart disease, stroke and so on. And they thought, well, this is just the result of its diabetes effect. But then it started to become clear that there was an independent effect. And in fact, this GLP-1, this chemical messaging system, doesn't just exist in the gut. It exists in the brain and lots of different tissues in the body.
Important to point out, to add balance here, that yes, there are all those potential other positive effects, but that same mapping study also found on these medications there was an increased risk of gastrointestinal disorders, hypotension or lower blood pressure and fainting episodes. So like anything, there is risk and benefit. But as you just said, in terms of the other impacts of these meds, there was the study that was published in The Lancet looking at obesity-related cancer, if you recall, that we discussed on the Health Report.
I if you say so. No, anyway, yeah. No, there's been so much, actually. It's hard to remember all the different studies.
But there are several obesity-related cancers that are commonly referred to. So things like meningiomas, adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, the stomach, colorectal cancer, there's several. This was a study that basically found that GLP-1 medications did not increase the risk of obesity-related cancer, but actually appeared to have a positive effect. And the positive
and this,
effect...
And this is, historically, this is people with diabetes.
That's right. But what was interesting about this study was that the benefit in terms of reducing the risk of obesity-related cancer was not limited to the weight loss alone. So it wasn't just a weight-related factor, but it was felt that perhaps because levels of inflammation were being addressed by the medication, that perhaps it was having additional benefits.
Yeah, and to decode that a little bit more, then what we're saying here is that if it was related to the weight loss, the greater the weight loss, the greater the effect on cancer prevention. But it seemed to be that the key variable was being on the drug rather than how much weight you lost. You know, it's hard to know where to draw the line on our discussion about this. But I mean, the other two phenomena with these drugs that I found really interesting during the year was that they could actually be treatments for addictions because of the way they affect the brain. And also people with schizophrenia who are on drugs which actually increase the risk of diabetes and increase the risk of obesity, these drugs might be useful to actually keep people's weight down and therefore happier to take their antipsychotic drugs.
We'll have a link to all of these wonderful stories so you can have a listen, but it's something we're going to keep talking about.
So what people are talking about now is, well, first of all, can we afford them? Are they going to break the bank if we put them on public subsidy for weight loss? Or could we actually recoup the investment in them by reducing the rate of chronic illness in the community through these drugs?
At the moment, and I know that there are TGA and PBS applications constantly occurring, but at the moment there is word of potentially an oral version of the medication, Norman, which might change the landscape for next year.
It might or may not be next year. But in fact, Novo Nordisk has an oral version of semaglutide, but it's not as effective as the injectable one. But there's been this huge competition, a bidding war for a weight loss startup called Metsera, which has got what they consider to be a very effective oral medication for weight loss. Novo Nordisk, which is in trouble because they are being beaten by, in a competitive sense, by Eli Lilly with their drug called tirzepatide. And Pfizer wants in the game, and they were bidding against Novo Nordisk for this company, Metsera, and Pfizer won with a $10 billion bid for the company.
And an oral version is heavily sought after for ease. So it's easier for people to store at the moment with the injectable medications. They need to be in the fridge. There's, of course, the component of injecting. So is that why this is so fought after? Because it's going to make it easier again for people?
Yeah, for some people it's a barrier. Some people like the injection, they feel that they're doing something, but the oral medication is going to be easier, potentially cheaper because you don't have to have this fancy device for injecting. That remains to be seen because drug companies are not known for charging less than they need to.
And it's been quite difficult to find an oral version, hasn't it, because of how it's digested?
Yes, these are peptides. So these are proteins which need to go straight into the bloodstream to have an effect, because one of the things that your stomach acid does is break down proteins. So if you've got a peptide drug, it needs to be injected unless they've found a way of either protecting the protein or the body converts it into that essential message. So it's a highly technical process to get these biologic drugs.
And Pfizer now owns it.
They do in that case, yes.
I just think it's worth, because we've covered GLP-1s a lot over the year with all this developing research, but I do feel that one of the most powerful things we did in the area was the chat with Dr. Sarah Trope from the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, where we actually discussed the notion that there are potential harms of these medications, that if they're being prescribed in people of higher weight, that people need to be screened for eating disorders, that eating disorders can exist in people of higher weight. There's a lot of weight stigma in the healthcare profession. And we've also focused on these telehealth services as well on the show, where people can get diagnosed, prescribed and dispensed certain medications all in one.
The idea here is you could have somebody with anorexia nervosa who effectively lies about their situation and they get prescribed these drugs. And having said that, there is a little bit of evidence that in binge eating disorder, I should say, they might actually help, but that's not to be generalized. So big year, these are major drugs, very expensive. They could break the bank, but they also could have enormous benefits. And in the years to come, we'll just see how they flow through the system.
I'm sure we will be talking about them well into 2026 as well. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
Okay, Priya, what's the story with bowel cancer and exercise?
It's fascinating, and it adds even more weight to why physical activity is good for all of us. But this...
You got very excited when you're off to do the interview.
I did. And I'm actually quite excited in the interview too. I have to say we were all quite excited because this adds a lot of weight, I think, to why we should all be physically active, particularly after bowel cancer and treatment. This is a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a randomised controlled trial involving 55 centres. Patients who'd had bowel cancer, who'd completed their chemotherapy, were randomised into two groups. One underwent a structured exercise program where they had regular contact with exercise physiologists. The other group were simply given health education materials. They didn't have all that additional support. They were simply told that exercise would be beneficial. The primary endpoint, the thing they were really looking at, was disease-free survival. And what they found was really quite remarkable in terms of the benefits of the structured exercise program.
But just before you go on, disease-free survival is one of the metrics they use in chemotherapy and radiation therapy.
That's right.
It's not head-to-head, but it's actually giving the same parameters that you would say, is chemo worth using? Is radiation worth using?
I spoke to two of the researchers, Jeanette Vardy, Professor of Cancer Medicine at the University of Sydney, and Hariana Dillon, Professor of Psycho-Oncology, also at the University of Sydney. And we're starting off with Professor Vardy on the details of the study and exactly what it found.
For disease-free survival, so in other words, have they had a recurrence of their cancer or have they developed another new primary cancer? What we found was that for the exercise group, disease-free survival was 80% compared to 74% in the health education material only. So this actually equates to a 28% risk reduction of a cancer recurrence.
Which is amazing.
It is. It's quite phenomenal.
It's very exciting. And that was independent of weight loss or a change in waist circumference, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes.
So the weight doesn't need to shift to yield benefit?
No. And then even probably more exciting was that for our overall survival, which we looked at for, say, 8 years, we had overall survival of 90% in the exercise group compared to 83%. So this equates to like a 37% reduction in their risk reduction of death. So the results were just really quite
astounding.
Extraordinary.
Yes. Yes. So why do we think, and this might be for both can answer this, but why do we think exercise yields this survival benefit? What are the mechanisms?
We don't actually know the mechanisms, but some of the things that we had already built into the study was looking at inflammation, so like a chronic inflammation, which can be reduced by long-term exercise. And the other thing that we were looking at was whether insulin-like growth factor, so making people less insulin resistance, which we know exercise can do. So what we think may happen is that there may be tiny little metastases that are still around after the chemotherapy treatment. And what we're looking at are mechanisms that may explain why in some people those tiny, tiny little cells then go on and you get a recurrence of the cancer, or can exercise decrease that?
And the other thing that we did find was that we had far fewer new primary cancers for breast cancer and prostate cancer in the intervention group than in the control group. And I think that's a really interesting aspect that we'll be exploring, and it may be an indicator that the mechanisms that we've hypothesized, so the insulin-like growth factor pathway and the inflammatory pathways, actually really do have an impact on, you know, the ability for cancer cells to take hold and grow.
So that was new prostate and breast cancer, was it, in the intervention group?
That's correct.
Mm. Amazing. Okay. So, Hariana, I noticed the intention in that intervention group was really to promote any aerobic exercise, and people could choose type, frequency, the duration. Do we think that the autonomy and actually enjoying the type of physical activity is an element as well?
I think absolutely people need to be doing something that they enjoy. But I might add that it might take them a little while to actually find enjoyment in their physical activity. So if you've been fairly sedentary, so we're talking about people who are not meeting the national guidelines for physical activity for adults, so 150 minutes of moderate physical activity a week, which equates to about 30 to 40 minutes of walking 4 or 5 days of the week. We took people who were not doing that, so they really hadn't engaged in exercise, and maybe some of them had had experiences in the past as kids at school or in their earlier adulthood where they didn't fit in, they didn't find what they needed to do. So actually getting them to do something and keep trying until they find the right fit. And I think also the duration. So we had a fairly intensive, our intervention was at least fortnightly supervised exercise sessions, and we really recommended that they did those sessions weekly for the first 6 months of the study. And that really makes a huge difference in terms of embedding activity in people's lives and supporting them so that it becomes a habit. And by 6 months, they really can start to see the benefits of the exercise in terms of how they're feeling and their energy levels and their fitness levels.
Do you think that social interaction as well played a role? Because I noted in the discussion in the paper, the people who were part of the intervention group in that structured exercise program had more social contact. So how much of an element does that play?
I think that's another aspect that makes it much more sustainable for people to continue with their exercise. If you're a part of a group and you have accountability to that group and you have connections with them and people support each other, it really adds to it. Some of our participants in the study in Sydney formed a walking group. And so we followed these people for quite some time. And so we'd ring them once a year after they'd sort of finished the active aspects of the study. And some of them were still meeting up with their regular challenge walking group once a week for a walk, and they really valued that connection.
So what are you hoping will change as a result of this study when it comes to cancer management?
This study tells us loud and clear that a structured exercise program needs to be embedded into standard of care, at least for our colon cancer patients. And it's probably sufficient that we consider it for all cancer patients. So Hariana and I were discussing just yesterday that if this had been a drug that we had come up with,
yes,
that showed this amount of improvement in disease-free survival and overall survival, not to mention without all the side effects, people would be clamoring for this to be on the PBS very quickly. So in the same way, we need to embed this, and it becomes standard that at the latest, when they've finished their chemotherapy, but maybe even earlier than that, people see an accredited exercise consultant and they're given a prescription for exercise with ongoing support, because we know from our health education material only group that just telling people to go out and exercise is not sufficient.
What's needed there then? Is it funding? Is it structural change within cancer units? What's the change that needs to happen?
I think all of those things. So we definitely need to increase the workforce of accredited exercise physiologists who are confident in working with people who've had a diagnosis of cancer. So I think embedding access to exercise activity in the actual cancer centres and nearby is really important, but also forming those links with community providers, because we don't want people to be coming back to the hospital all the time if they don't need to and they can get that support in the community. I think the other thing is that there were many people who would just not even engage with a discussion about exercise during or post their cancer treatment. So I think the next big question for me as a psycho-oncologist is, how do we actually get people to be open to the idea of exercise, and how do we move them from saying, no, I'm not interested, to yes, I'd like to try it, and then getting them the support to do that?
Patients frequently ask us as oncologists, you know, okay, I finished my chemotherapy, what can I do now to help preventing this cancer coming back? And, you know, for a long time we've been saying exercise, but now there's this really strong evidence. So it should hopefully be quite empowering to people, as long as they have the facilities to help them to do that.
That was Professor Jeanette Vardy and Professor Hariana Dillon, both at the University of Sydney.
It's not instead of chemo.
It is not instead. And both Jeanette and Hariana actually said that this is in the context of surgery, chemotherapy, so the conventional medical therapies, and exercise after. So it's not instead of, it's in addition to.
And I can't move on with this story without saying, if you're eligible for bowel cancer screening in Australia, that means you're over 45.
Yes.
Do it. Why do 60% of Australians would rather die of colon cancer than do the test or end up in this situation where you're having surgery, chemotherapy, and going through all this? Have the bloody test.
And if you do have symptoms like blood in your stools or a change in bowel habit, don't do the test. Go and speak to your GP because you likely need more investigation.
Yeah, because the test is screening, not diagnosis.
On Radio National, you're with the Health Report. This next story, Norman, is about Kylie and Gillian, two friends who've had strokes many years apart. This episode explores Kylie's journey and you hear from her children and her husband. And I have to say that as a health professional listening, I found it quite moving hearing Kylie relive the day of her stroke and share her decision for having children. This is a very special story to listen to with some very unique insights.
And it's part of a series, and this is episode one, and we'll also have it online. But here's the story.
When we started the breakfast on Thursday morning, it was like, we're going to conquer the world.
Yes, we had the power breakfast.
Yes.
And we
would sit
there and solve the world's problems. And we saw the sky was the limit.
Yeah.
My husband was going to raise the kids if we had children.
Yep. And I remember that.
He was going to take the time off work and let me continue on my huge path to success.
We were about 28 then, so a few years before you had the stroke. Take me back to that morning.
Well, it started a day like any other day. I was at home getting ready to go to work. I was having breakfast and I had this incredibly painful toothache and I had made an emergency appointment to see the dentist. It all gets a bit hazy from here. I was preparing to go out, dressed for work and everything, and all of a sudden everything just went black. I would wake up and try and call somebody, but I couldn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
It came to the time for my meeting and my secretary didn't know where I was and couldn't contact me, so they rang Chris.
I had a number of different scenarios going through in my head as to what had happened to you that day, but things weren't normal. So I wasn't sure what to expect when I got home and found you unresponsive on the couch.
I had been there for literally hours.
6 hours or something.
Yeah.
Then I called the ambulance, said I think my partner's had a stroke, and we took you to the Royal Sydney Hospital.
The next thing I remember was Chris going with me in the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And I remember I just bought this brand new skirt and I was wearing it for the first day. And I remember the doctor getting a pair of scissors and cutting my skirt off.
Yep.
And I remember at the time being horrified. Do you have any recollections then of what happened next?
You know, I guess I was looking for certainty and none of the doctors could give any certainty apart from the fact that it was quite a severe stroke and, you know, recovery from stroke is not linear and it's not normal. They were also very honest and transparent in terms of, you know, likelihood of recovery. Look, it was a life-changing moment. Right, so I was grappling with loss and shock.
So what were you thinking, Kylie? Did you have a sense of what had happened?
I kind of knew there was something fairly major wrong. I couldn't comprehend that I'd had a stroke. And I always look at this time as being really hard on everyone else, on my husband and my friends and my family, because for them, they thought I was dying. Mm. And then when I had gained consciousness again, I wasn't the same person.
Mm.
But my husband got our close group of friends and he told them all that I wasn't to eat hospital food because I didn't like hospital food. So they all took a turn about of cooking. It was moments like that that I really knew that people cared.
What the main thing I remember is just how much you had changed and how it sounds so awful, but I was fascinated because you knew exactly what you were saying, but it came out all gobbledygook for me, and that was fascinating.
Because when you learn to talk again, what you're saying to yourself is a certain something, but what you actually physically say is completely different.
Yeah.
And my parents, like, I love them to death, but my parents, they would just brush over it and just say, oh, isn't that nice? Whereas Chris and my best friend Amanda would all of a sudden stop me and say, no, hang on.
What do you mean?
Wait a minute.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, try again. So I was still at that stage just prior to the birth of my first child.
So this was 12 months after the stroke. You decided to have kids. What were you thinking?
Well, came down to, we're going to have children one day. Why don't we have them now while I'm recovering from the stroke?
Oh my God.
And throw that into the mix.
Yep, of course.
Because it made sense to us that we used the time I was off work anyway to begin the family.
Yep.
Now, we hadn't thought through entirely what that meant. And it was that same look from my hospital because they knew I was stubborn and pig-headed. And when I told them, they thought, oh, well, if anyone can do it, you can. But let's just work out how you're going to do it. You could see people thinking, oh, my God, what are they doing? What do you recall growing up with having a mother who had a stroke? Did you realise I was different or?
Because I'd grown up with my mum having the stroke, I didn't really think of it as abnormal or different. So I was at school one time and mum came to pick me up and it just was really weird because these kids would just be staring at her and then they'd ask me once she was out of earshot, like, what's wrong with your mum? Why is she limping? And stuff like that. And up until that point, I never really considered that there would be something different about my mum because it was just normal to me and I didn't think about it.
Yeah, I've got a similar experience of just, it took me a while to even realise that there was something different or unique about my mother. Probably took when I first went over to another kid's house, met their family, realised that my family was different than theirs.
It's so interesting because Corey and Baron didn't know you before you had the stroke, but obviously I did. And I remember at that time, and I'm so embarrassed to say it, but it needs to be talked about because I thought the reality is you're not quite the same. And so we kind of lost touch.
Yeah, I'd still class us as friends.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through that phase.
Absolutely.
We often thought about each other and that, but we didn't touch base. And I was so much based on recovery because I always took it as, right, this is where I am today.
Yeah.
This is what I've got to get over to make it to tomorrow. And if I can do that, then I can slowly build myself up and I can recover. Because I was determined to fully recover at that stage.
Yep, absolutely. And I'm laughing not at you, but actually with you. Because when you had your stroke, I couldn't really understand what you were going through. Not really, but now I can.
Yeah, you ended up at the same rehabilitation centre as me.
Yeah, when I had my stroke 20 years later.
You'll hear more about Gillian's story next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can check out all four episodes of A Stroke of Luck on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have to say, Norman, the part of Kylie's story that really struck me was when she said the health professionals cut off her skirt.
Yeah.
And she had a good dose of humour. It is. And it's the things that sometimes we, as the doctor, you forget. That's a new skirt and she'd bought it for her work. But a very beautiful and insightful story.
So here's an unusual way for us to get into a story, Priya.
It's quite pleasant.
Do you recognise it? This is your starter for 10.
I do know this, but I can't name it or the musician.
Or the composer.
Composer.
Well, this is The Bolero by Maurice Ravel. And it relates to our next story because Ravel had a neurodegenerative disease and he had a burst of creativity while he had that. And the composition of The Bolero, according to some people, was associated with that burst of creativity. So why do people who have brain damage or neurodegenerative disease get a burst of creativity? And what does it say, really, for ourselves about how to boost our own creativity? And to talk about that, I spoke to Dr. Isaiah Kletnik, who's a cognitive neurologist at Harvard Medical School in Boston.
As a cognitive neurologist, I take care of patients who have dementias, neurodegenerative diseases, and there are these rare situations in which people have a progressive brain disease, but they have new onset creativity later in life with the disease.
How does that manifest?
It depends on the person. There are some very famous cases. For example, there's speculation that Ravel had frontotemporal dementia that may have had an impact on his composition of Bolero and other pieces. But it depends on the person. Sometimes painters will become more abstract in their painting. Other times writers will produce more and use language in unusual or uncharacteristic ways. So it depends on the form.
Difficult thing to study, though.
Oh, it's very difficult. I follow several patients who have neurodegenerative diseases who are artists, and I ask them to show me their art, whether it's visual or in writing, because it's quite interesting to see how things change.
So tell me about this study.
This was a really fun project. We looked at a number of neuroimaging studies of healthy controls who had done creative tasks. And this was a whole group of different creative tasks to derive a brain circuit associated with creativity. This really goes across the creative domains. There was musical composition, vocalizations, creative writing, and there were also more formal psychometric metrics. And so the first step was we derived a brain circuit which was sensitive and specific for creativity, regardless of the creative domain.
Then you boil down the existing evidence. You looked at what's called functional MRI, where you look at the brain in action and you can typify areas that are active in certain circumstances. And you concluded it boiled down to a specific network.
Yeah, we were really surprised by the key finding because it was actually a deactivation in the right frontal pole. We often think about areas where there's increased activation. But in this study, the key finding was that all the creative tasks seemed to share deactivation in the right frontal pole.
So the testable hypothesis is you got to keep some of your brain at bay if you want to be creative.
Yeah, absolutely. So the testable hypothesis was if deactivation is associated with creativity, then brain injuries to the right frontal pole or connected to the right frontal pole would increase creativity.
So what you found was that possibly the cause of increased creativity in neurodegenerative disease is that you've got this inhibition of the right front side of the brain. Where was the main action in terms of the creativity itself? Because couldn't that be affected by Parkinson's or Lewy body disease or Alzheimer's?
When you consider a creative task, there are clearly parts of the brain that must be active. If you consider, let's say, dance, clearly motor planning regions must be active. If you consider visual art, clearly vision-related regions of the brain must be active. And so we derived a domain general circuit. The idea really was they all coincided on turning off a function of the brain.
Now, people who research psychedelics say similar things about creativity, is that there's this inhibitory network on the brain which stops overactivity and focuses the brain on action and getting things done and decisions being made. But if you lift this off, and that's what psychedelics do, then you get a burst of creativity because circuits that were hitherto suppressed are now relieved. Is there any overlap with psychedelics here?
There may be. My research really doesn't focus on that. I think what is interesting and possible is that the right frontal pole is important for monitoring and error detection. And it may well be that deactivating the right frontal pole is important because to be creative, you need to allow yourself to make mistakes. You need to allow yourself to do something novel and unique and to not be so specific in your self-criticism. If psychedelics do that, then there may be an overlap between the two, but hard for me to say off the cuff.
And what about you or me with no damage to that area?
The data about the brain function is what it is. And then the question is the interpretation. If the right frontal pole is involved in inhibiting creativity, then it's possible that a brain stimulation, such as with transcranial magnetic stimulation or other direct current stimulation, could hypothetically increase creativity if done to the correct circuit. I'm not advocating for that. It is a testable hypothesis. If, in fact, the right frontal pole is important to deactivate because it's involved in error monitoring or criticism, then there is another testable hypothesis, which would be if you would just purposefully reduce your self-monitoring and criticism, perhaps you could also increase your creativity.
So a randomized trial of writer's block, I'm sure they'll be lining up for it.
Yeah, you know, N of one, each of us could try it and see how it goes.
Absolutely. We love N of one studies on the Health Report. I mean, you're flipping the scales here, aren't you, Isaiah? We normally think of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's or traumatic brain injury as negative, deficit. But you're now talking about a positive.
Absolutely. Most often, brain diseases of these kind are very debilitating and can have major negative consequences on people's lives. On the other hand, I think one of the key points of our study is that there can be situations in which neurodegenerative diseases or brain injury can actually increase certain functions. In our case, we are describing how people with specific forms of brain injury and certain forms of dementia actually show increases in creativity. And this is an important paradigm that we see in a number of other instances in neurology where there can be examples of brain diseases where people's creativity or people's function increase as a result of those diseases.
Dr. Isaiah Kletinik is a cognitive neurologist at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
I feel like if I did quieten certain aspects of my brain, maybe I could be more creative, like you.
I'm terrified to actually see what that looks like, but we'll find out. On Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
That's the Health Report for this week, but don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash?, where we answer the health questions everyone is asking.
Yeah, and this week the question is, can you train yourself to wee less? It's a popular question. There's a lot out there promising to help you out. We'll cover what works and what doesn't. But could you excuse me a moment? See you next week.
I'll see you then.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.